From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
When he's asked what he does for a living, Luca Turin answers that he's a fragrance chemist. Although he's a biophysicist, perfume inspired him to go beyond his specialty to investigate the science of smell, and he's developed a theory on how the nose perceives scent. His new book, The Secret of Scent, Adventures in Perfume and the Science of Smell, is published by Echo. I'm very pleased it has brought Luca Turin to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
When did you first become interested in perfumes?
I think it really started in the early 80s. I had been sort of sporadically interested in perfume until then, but then at that point I discovered, I was living in Nice, and I discovered that the place was full of old perfume stores with old perfumes, and they were selling for very little. And so I started collecting fragrance, and that was the big, that was the beginning of my...
And you talk about a particular perfume, Nombre Noir,
yes.
That inspired you. What is it? That's Black Number.
Yes. It was a... amazing perfume, actually. They came out in 82, and it was Shiseido, the Japanese firm's first European fragrance. And it smelled so wonderful that I still remember the first day I smelled
it. Well, where is it now?
Well, what happened to it was discontinued 2 years later, and then I raved about it enough in various places, including a little perfume book and various, that it's now impossible to buy because a half ounce goes for $800 or $900 on eBay. So I don't have any. I only have a tiny sample.
So you had a whiff of this perfume.
Yes.
And that sent you off in another direction. What had you been planning to do as a biophysicist?
Well, what I was doing at the time was I was interested in proteins as semiconductors, and the notion that you could actually build, you know, diodes and transistors from proteins. And I had this harebrained notion that maybe smell worked in the way that electronic noses worked, in other words, with semiconductors. It turned out to be completely wrong. But that's how I got started, and that's how I got funding to study smell.
Can you clear up the business of your background? I mean, you have an Italian name.
Yes.
You spend a lot of time in France. You speak like an American.
Yes. I was brought up in France. French is my mother tongue. I speak Italian with a weird accent. And for some reason, I speak American. I can't really explain it. So my friends say it's alien abduction, but that's how it happened.
So before we get into how our noses work, let's talk a bit about perfumes. How are they made? What are the raw materials?
The palette of the perfumer today is about 3,000 different materials, and I would say maybe one-third of those would be naturals. And the naturals are very complicated mixtures of things, so they're already perfumes almost in their own right. And the remainder are synthetics. And good perfumes, since the dawn of chemistry in 1880 or thereabouts, have always been a judicious mixture of synthetics and naturals.
But why does it seem obvious that some inexpensive perfumes are almost made up totally of synthetics? Is that just my imagination? They don't smell real.
No, they don't. And I think the budget, you know, if you look at really cheap fragrances have a budget of $5 a kilo or $6 a kilo for the oil, okay, that no natural can be bought for that kind of money. A really fine fragrance might have $150 a kilo for the oil budget, and then you can put in some expensive stuff.
And you say that they're combinations. Do they work together? Are some more difficult to work with than others?
The art of perfumery is really... it's extraordinarily difficult to get right. Very few. It takes, you know, maybe two decades to really get on top of it. And I think it's an art as it's as complicated as directing movies or writing music.
But you argue that in a culture that's concerned with natural versus chemical, this is a moot point when we're talking about perfume.
Yes, I think it is. I think the notion that man-made chemicals are somehow have the stamp of the devil on them, and that everything that nature does is good, is a naive notion. It's just basically wrong.
Well, how are the synthetics made then?
Well, of course they're made
by... with a chemistry set?
Yes, they're made in vast stainless steel, containers that are well stirred and kept warm. And people who think that nature knows everything best should just go and, try some hemlock.
Do they smell the same as natural scents?
No. We have a good nose for complexity. The nose can tell, much in the way that, if you listen to an early Moog synthesizer, there's something bare, wonderful, but bare about the sound. We can tell a grand piano from a fake one, and we can tell the complexity from simplicity in chemical terms.
So you just, by adding all of these different things together, we're making them feel more and more profound.
Yes, what great perfumery tries to achieve is abstraction. So you take rose and jasmine and you make something that doesn't smell of rose and jasmine. It smells completely more than the sum of its parts.
But we are using fragrance bases like florals, fruits,
yes,
and woods.
Yes.
And the story of making musk has been particularly interesting. It's one of the first ones to become synthesized?
Yes, it was. Musk was a quite fantastically expensive material, the glands of musk deer and so on.
I always wondered why anybody wanted that.
It smells
like ambergris.
Yes.
A whale vomit never struck me as the most romantic thing in the world.
These things smell pretty good in themselves, but they also do something to fragrance. If you put them in a fragrance, it's like varnish on a painting. Something happens to the fragrance. It gets depth and richness. Okay, so they've been valued as much for the effect as for the smell. And in 1888, I think, a fellow called Bauer, who was trying to make a version of TNT, making better explosives, discovered he'd made a really lousy explosive, but that smelled terrific. And he switched, to give him credit. He understood what he had, and he became one of the early fragrance chemists.
Now, we know that our sense of smell is different from other animals. All I have to do is watch my dog on the street. How does that apply here? Are human receptors more attuned to certain sorts of things, and would that lead us to like certain scents more than others?
It's hard to know. What I find strange is how uninterested dogs are in perfume. Have you noticed? If you spray perfume in the back of your hand and put it in front of your dog, they look the other way.
He doesn't want to lick it.
They're not interested, okay? So whereas we seem to be attracted by the same things the bees like, flowers, it's just odd because we don't have a strong kinship to insects normally. But I think those things are pretty mysterious yet. We don't really know.
Would it be possible to smell something if we didn't have receptors already prepared to smell them?
That's a very good question. Nobody knows. We have 340 different receptors. And you will find that when you're dealing with large molecules like musks, if I showed you, for example, five or six different industry standard musks, you would probably not be able to smell at least one of them. It would be completely odorless to you. So perfumers put several to make sure that somebody always smelled it.
My guest is Luca Turin, T-U-R-I-N. His book, The Secret of Scent, Adventures in Perfume and the Science of Smell, is published by Echo. Now, there have been competing theories as to how scents even, the molecular shapes of scents, haven't there been?
Yes, there's been a pretty tough battle between two competing views. One which says that what we smell in a molecule is the shape, so that all rose smelling molecules will have something similar in their shape.
And can we prove that?
It's put it this way, it's very hard to prove or disprove, but the fact is, if it were so, and if it were self-evidently so, people would be designing molecules by shape, which they're not. The big firms that make new chemicals for smell do it at random. Okay, so they clearly don't have a roadmap.
But you say vibration is the...
Right, contender, right from the start, the other contender has been that we smell the vibrations of molecules. And that was always a maverick theory.
It almost sounds like string theory.
Yeah. The problem with that theory was always that nobody could understand how the nose might do it. Because, an instrument that measures molecular vibration is a big thing the size of this table, and you don't see it in the nose, and so people wonder, how is it done? And that's what I've contributed is not the idea, which was old, but a means by which it might happen in biology.
So this was not the most popular theory when you started working on it?
It was dead as a doornail. It was considered completely implausible.
And now, do most scientists go along with it?
No. Most scientists do not. Science takes time. And the jury is still out as to whether it's right or wrong.
Well, what is some of the evidence for the correctness of your theory?
Well, the evidence, I mean, the most, in my opinion, compelling daily evidence is the fact that I've been designing molecules at a very efficiently, you know, for the last 4 years using it every day.
In connection with perfumes.
Yes, I work for a startup, a U.S. startup firm, which was built around the idea that if my theory was correct, then there would be no need to make hundreds of molecules to get one right, that you could calculate the smell. And that's what we've been doing, and it works. So to that extent, empirically, it seems to be doing very well.
Do you have to have an exceptional sense of smell, a trained nose, to do this kind of work?
Not really.
This isn't like the wine experts who...
Wine is much more difficult. All wines are kind of like wine. You know, perfumes are very different from each other. I'm really impressed by wine masters. Perfumery, I think, is a lot easier.
One of the most famous ones, Robert Parker, has actually insured his nose, but people in the perfume business don't. I've also heard that women are generally better at smelling these things than men. They have a better sense of smell.
I don't know of a single perfumer whose nose is insured. I think that's pretty reckless, actually, in some cases. The probability of losing your sense of smell after a severe cold is non-zero. You know, one out of 2,000 people never recovers their smell after a
cold. Wow.
So it's serious. And yes, women are generally better.
Well, since smell and taste are linked, mm-hmm. how does that work? And how does that work with your vibration theory?
Well, what we call taste, as in when you swallow something, is 99% smell. If you really have a strong cold, you can't tell fish soup from yogurt. And that's it.
So, we once did a test here with a scientist from the Manil Institute mm-hmm. where we put nose clips on and tasted jelly beans or some, I can't remember what they were, with very powerful tastes, and we could not taste them until we took the nose clips off.
That's right. And I don't think people realize that taste, you know, what happens in the tongue is very, very basic compared to smell.
So vibration is doing that?
It's the same organ. Whether the smell reaches you from the back of your palate or from your nostrils, it hits the same spot at the top of your nose.
You've written a really readable book here. Was it your intention to make complicated scientific ideas accessible to the general public?
I don't understand complicated scientific ideas myself very easily, so I have to make them simple for my own use. So, and I think once you've understood something, it should be clear to all, you know.
And you use a lot of metaphors here.
Yeah.
I was wondering whether that is the result of all your years in the French academic world.
I don't know. That's a good question. No, I think the metaphors, you know, that's how I always try and explain things to the students when I, you know, that's how I understand things myself, by hand waving and by similes, because I'm not very good at mathematics.
When do you think we will resolve the conflict as to just how the molecular shapes and vibrations work? Or could it be a combination of the two?
Oh, it's definitely a combination. I think the intensity of a smell is the shape, and the character will be the vibration. But I think science moves at its own pace, and it depends on a lot of unforeseen factors. You know, is an experiment possible? Is it... it could happen quickly, it could happen slowly. I think you have to be patient.
You said that you've developed your own company. It's Flexitrol, where you're putting your vibration theory to work. How is that working?
What we've done that's unusual is that we are the only, so to speak, drug discovery company in the field. We discover new molecules in response to perceived industry needs, and what we sell is the actual intellectual property, not necessarily drums of the molecule. We patent a novel molecule, and we license the patent to people who make the flavors.
There's still a need for new inventions in perfume?
Very much so. Both perfume and flavor world are driven by new molecules. Everybody wants a new... or in the particular thing that's happening now is they want replacement for old things that are turned out to be allergens, for example, We've done a number of replacements for allergens.
And it's interesting that there are actually changes in style. We can smell a perfume that was popular in the 20s and know that it's old-fashioned, even though it's quite wonderful.
Yes. There's a very, very strong sense of time in perfumery. You can tell to the nearest 5 years when something was composed. There's cliches and also raw materials that they used, fashionable materials at the time.
Violet at one point, no
longer.
Yes, that's
right. Violet was a long time ago. Everybody still hates violets, although even their grandmother didn't wear it. It's strange.
Because it seems too sweet.
Yes.
I understand you're writing a guide for perfume.
Yes, this is my latest project. I'm working on with my co-author, Tania Sanchez. We're working on a proper guide to fragrance with a couple, 1,500 or so fragrances in there, reviewed and criticized and appreciated, and also the background to the industry.
On the cover of your book, we get the title, subtitle, your name, and one fluid ounce.
Yes, I insisted on one fluid ounce. Initially, it was a half an ounce, and I said, I'm not that cheap. Make it
this
bigger.
Book is really one fluid ounce. It's a lot of fun. And also, I will, I think that the next time I take a whiff of a perfume, I will have a whole different kind of insight. Have you thought a lot about how men's perfumes are so different than women's?
Yes, I think less artistry.
Oh, we just get the cruder ones?
Yeah.
Oh, this won't work for women. We'll pass it off as a man.
I think that's
scent.
It's a hand-me-down.
Luca Turin's book, The Secret of Scent, Adventures in Perfume and the Science of Smell, is published by Echo. And I want to thank you so much for being with
thank
us
you.
Today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.